This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Okay, and with that, no, it is not time for Housing Notebook. It is time for something else, because it's midnight here on listener-supported, non-commercial, use-it-or-lose-it, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. And once again, big thanks to everybody out there who gave it up for Delphine Blue. Greatly appreciated. And those of you who did not pledge for Delphine Blue, well, now comes your big opportunity to pledge for this.
Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news. Only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
right. Well, that, as you might have surmised from the lyrics, was Buster Brown's 1960 hit Fannie Mae for our financial crisis special tonight. Get it? we're having a financial crisis here at WBAI, just like the rest of the world is having a financial crisis. So it's incumbent upon everybody out there to support WBAI tonight, and you know how to do that by calling 212-209-2950. And if you're not a member of this radio station and you're listening, then you know what to do. It's real easy. Just call 212-209-2950 and pledge what you can to become a member. $25 is the minimum pledge to actually become a voting member of WBAI and to actually have a voice in the democratic process, which is unfolding here at the Pacifica Network, and to show your love for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, which is what you're listening tonight with me, Bill Weinberg. And also, we've got some groovy premiums. First and foremost, on the subject of the financial crisis, we've got a book which we are offering for a pledge of $50, just double the minimum pledge for a membership. And the book is entitled How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy by Mark Engler, who we're privileged to be joined by tonight. Welcome aboard, Mark.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
And your book came out this year, and it's certainly right, 2008 copyright, isn't it?
That's right. It was out in the spring.
So just as the global economy started to fall apart, your book came out.
That's absolutely right.
A very prescient title.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I talk in the book about trends that have been going on for a longer period of time. You know, I believe now that we've lived through two failed visions of how to rule the world. We had one vision that we saw during the Clinton years, a vision of corporate globalization. That was a vision of market fundamentalism, of what in other parts of the world is known as neoliberalism. And, of course, this is neoliberalism in economics. I think your listeners may be familiar with it, not liberalism in politics as we know it in the United States, which tends to be, you know, sort of left of center liberal. Liberalism in economics is laissez-faire. It's handover ever larger sections of public life to the unregulated free market.
Well, liberalism in as it's used in this country as opposed to the rest of the world has got an economic component as well, and it ironically means the opposite of that, right? It means, you know, Keynesianism and state intervention and the New Deal and et cetera.
Right, so. Right. But when I'm talking about neoliberalism, I'm talking about that that model, which is this is you know, which was implemented under Bill Clinton and under other governments throughout the world. This is something that's been imposed by the institutions of the Washington Consensus, the International Monetary Fund, and World Bank, World Trade Organization. That means privatization, taking public businesses, public enterprise, handing it over, selling it off to people in the private sector. This means deregulation, letting the corporate lobbyists write the rules for their own industries. This means austerity, cuts to social services, rolling back the welfare state. We saw all of that take place during the Clinton years under that model of corporate globalization, where foreign policy was run through those institutions that I mentioned, the institutions of the Washington Consensus. There was a focus on use of soft power, which is the non-military means, economic means of persuasion. That was the vision that we saw implemented then. Well, in the Bush years, we saw something different. You know, some of us, when Bush first came into office, started stressing the continuities between the two. You know, Bush also talked about supporting free trade and what have you. But Bush actually very quickly showed that he was pursuing a slightly different model of how to rule the world, how to enforce U.S. power. And this is what I call imperial globalization rather than corporate globalization. Here, there was a much greater focus on the use of the military, much greater focus on hard power. there was an allegiance with certain sectors of the economy, big arms, big oil, over other sections of the economy. We had the neocons come into power. And this imperial globalization had many of the same characteristics that we associate with Bush and with the Republicans under Bush. You know, this very ultra-nationalism, this unilateralism, this highly partisan type of behavior. So there are important differences there. You know, there was a marked change in how we saw the United States exercise power. And the reason I think that this is very important is because of the moment we're experiencing now, you know, where we have a shift to, a new president, to Barack Obama. Interestingly, you know, the Bush presidency was so disastrous that it wasn't just leftists that were criticizing this. You know, Bush lost the support even of large sections of capital, particularly not the business elite that was not the Halliburtons and Blackwaters. It was not the big arms, the big oils. It was not, you know, the type of the sectors of the economy that were most closely aligned with the state. All of the, you know, sort of mega brands that we talked a lot about during the era of corporate globalization, the Starbucks, the McDonald's, the Microsoft, the finance capital, all of these type of business enterprises, there was a growing awareness that this neocon stuff was crazy, you know, that this was really a bad way to run the world. It was something that...
Right, and when you say the neocon stuff, you mean the hyper-interventionism...
That's right.
The militarism and...
Right, yeah. Preemptive war in Iraq. And this war in Iraq was creating backlash in all of those markets that those multinational corporations worked so hard to open up. You know, it was, in their language, they said, this is destroying brand America. This is destroying our ability to do business abroad. Those businesses were not funding the Republican Senate campaigns. They were funding the Democratic Party this time around. You know, these are the type of sectors that overwhelmingly got behind Obama. Now, we're seeing a very interesting thing now that we do have a new president. I think that there are some...
Well, actually, we don't quite yet, but...
right.
We're assuming we're going to.
Assuming we're going to. I think that's a safe assumption. We're seeing now a battle for the economic soul of Barack Obama, where on the one hand... you have a very energized electorate. You know, you have people who were a progressive base that was really, did a lot of work to get Obama elected. This base was demanding a new type of economic policy. Very clearly, this base has rejected NAFTA and the politics of so-called free trade. So the Democratic candidates had to come out against NAFTA. They had to come out against that Clinton model of corporate globalization. And there were some interesting moments on the campaign trail that this created, which we can talk more about. But on the other hand, you have a lot of, not only the campaign donors, but you have a lot of the more conservative economic advisors who are very much part of that Clinton model of deregulation, of privatization, of corporate globalization. These are the Larry Summers, the Robert Rubins, and unfortunately some of these people now are in the administration. So we're seeing a battle being fought out. And I think that on the left, we need the language to be able to say, you know, sure, there's continuities here, you know, in exercising U.S. power, but there's some differences. You know, Clinton was not the same as Bush, and Obama was not the same as Bush. At the same time, if Obama is simply going to be a reversion from that imperial model of imperial model of globalization back to the corporate model, back to that Clintonian corporate model of globalization, well, that's not a model that we want. That's not a model that lives up to this slogan, this mandate for change.
Mm-hmm. So this raises the whole question of, you know, what is the this is actually getting ahead of your book, since your book came out before the election. But it raises the very interesting question, which perhaps we could talk about a little, of, you know, what is the appropriate stance for activists and the remnants of the left, what's left of the left, as we're going into the Obama era?
Right. Well, there's domestic questions. You know, there's questions about how we, continue to organize here in the United States. And then there's international questions. There's questions that put what we're experiencing here in the United States in a larger context. To start with the second point first, You know, one of the interesting things when we talk about the financial crisis here in the United States and some of the things that we're experiencing is we talk about this as sort of a new thing. You know, this is maybe it started last year with the, you know, when the subprime sector of the housing market started to implode, and then this has spread, and it's, you know, been a year and a half now where this has been an evolving crisis. Well, you know, on a global scene, on a global scale, the crisis of market fundamentalism is something we've been experiencing for at least 10 years, at least 10 years, at least going back to the Asian financial crisis, that was 97, 98, you know, where you saw a lot of the same characteristics. You know, you saw controls on capital removed, money, you know, speculative finance, you have trillions of dollars racing around the globe every day. They poured into East Asia when, you know, money could be made in the housing markets there. People made gambles on those economies. At the first sign of trouble, the money rushed out through those economies into crisis. That was a crisis of market fundamentalism that was experienced there in East Asia that spread throughout a lot of parts of the world. We saw the collapse of Argentina's economy in 2001. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Argentina had previously been a model pupil of the International Monetary Fund. It had been a country that had been held up as an example of how developing countries were meant to behave. Its whole economy implodes, you know, in December 2001. You have massive protests on the streets. You have a series of governments thrown out in quick succession. The slogan was que se van todos, out with them all. Mm-hmm. The point here is that, and then that was not an isolated incident. You know, the resistance in Argentina has been mirrored throughout the hemisphere, where we've seen election after election after election since the year 2000 that's put center-left or left governments in power. We've seen corresponding social movements that's holding a lot of those governments accountable, where there's a interplay between the street and the state.
Yes.
And that's a massive shift that we're seeing that's a result of the crisis of both of these models. You know, I think that's what the interesting thing that we're seeing. Because of the failures of corporate globalization, the failures of that model to produce growth, to deliver benefits for working people throughout the world, but particularly in the Americas, there's been a rejection of that. There's been a backlash against that. There's been a backlash against the Bush model, you know, because the war in Iraq is so disastrous.
Even domestically and even within the Beltway.
Sure, absolutely. You know, I mean, Bush's approval ratings are in the 20s, and, you know, McCain has to distance himself from Bush. There's a huge realignment to the Democrats. But throughout the world, there's a huge rejection of this model of exercise.
He's getting shoes thrown at him in Baghdad.
He's dodging shoes. Exactly. And so the failure of both of those models in some ways has created some spaces of hope. You know, it's created a more open debate now about that question of how to rule the world, but what sort of international society we want to have. And for those of us who don't believe in the corporate model, who don't believe in the imperial model, who say none of the above, who say out with them all, well, this backlash is producing some exciting things. And this is the model that I call democratic globalization, or globalization from below. You know, I don't think we necessarily need to coin a new term here, but we do need to identify that this resistance that's happening throughout the Americas, it's happening in other parts of the world, is rejecting both those models. It's trying to create a different way of being a global society that's based on democracy, it's based on human rights, it's based on a more just distribution of resources.
Okay, well, if it's based on a more just redistribution of resources and presumably based on, you know, local control as opposed to global control and distant centers of power commanding resources all over the world, then in what sense is it globalization? I mean, around the movement that began with the Seattle protest, we called it the anti-globalization movement. So, but now you're talking about an alternative form of globalization.
Well, this is partly a semantic discussion.
Yes.
But, you know, but I do choose these words intentionally.
Yes.
Now, you know, when you say we called it the anti-globalization movement, that's only partially accurate because, you know, of course, the media, mainstream media, jumped on that term, anti-globalization. And what I think people in the movement very quickly found is that produced a very shallow debate. You know, it produced a debate that positioned activists as, you know, isolationists, as reactionaries, as people who are just sort of fighting against the future. And that rhetoric of globalization, while it was very prominent in the United States, was not so prominent in other parts of the world. So in Latin America, for example, well, they were against neoliberalism. They didn't talk so much about globalization. Here, no one knows what neoliberalism is. But the difference there is very critical, because globalization, it's so vague. It can mean anything. It can mean technology. It can mean communications. And so if you're fighting against globalization, you're just sort of fighting against the future. And then you have the right-wing critics saying, well, look, they carry around cell phones at these protests. Aren't they hypocrites? You know, because this is globalization. But, these movements were always extremely internationalist. They were always fundamentally about building connections between movements in different parts of the world. So I believe that we have every right to claim that global mantle, that internationalist mantle, every bit as much as capital does. And therefore, in the movement, you very quickly had a shift to people using global justice movement rather than anti-globalization movement. Right. Well, global justice, now that's a very different type of term. It's a very different terminology. Hmm. You had in Europe a move to use the term alter-globalization. That doesn't have the same zing as far as I'm concerned, but, you know, the point is the same. You know, we're not going to get bogged down in that shallow debate. This isn't a question of whether we're going to have some type of global exchange, of global communication, of solidarity that is cross-border, that is genuinely global. We do want that, but the question is globalization on whose terms? Are we globalizing on the terms of capital? You know, corporate globalization? Are we globalizing on the terms of the U.S. military? Imperial globalization, or are we globalizing on democratic terms? Now, there's that Zapatista slogan that says, we want a world in which many worlds fit. Well, that's a very interesting idea, right? Because it's a global vision, right? But it's a vision of global diversity. It's saying we don't want a monoculture world, right? Now, that doesn't mean that there's not going to be communication, cross-fertilization, but it means that there's space for diversity within a global order. So I think that's a challenge. I think that there's a tension. There's a tension in even within the movement between the sort of localist impulse and this and a legitimate desire to say democracy has to be local. You know, it has to take place at the grassroots level, at the community level. And, you know, that people, you want economic decisions as well as political decisions to be made as much as possible at those levels. On the other hand, attention between that and having solidarity, having exchange, having, having economic exchange too, having trade, not on, you know, so-called free trade terms, but on fair trade terms. But the point being, I do think we have every bit as much right to claim that internationalist mantle. That's why I use the phrase democratic globalization, and I do find it sparks a very different type of debate about these issues than if you say anti-globalization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, basically, your book is sort of posing the neoliberal model as the so-called Washington consensus against these little bubbling movements, some more revolutionary, others more reformist, which have sprung up particularly most strongly, I would say, in Latin America. You've got a whole chapter on Latin America, which looks at the crisis in Argentina that you just mentioned, as well as the Zapatista movement in Mexico and some other examples, and sort of posing all of this in terms of there's actually going to be, as your subtitle implies, a coming battle for the global economy. And certainly much which has transpired since the book came out has sort of heightened the contradictions and made this all much more relevant.
Well, I think that there is a battle. I mean, there's no question that there's going to be a battle. I mean, there's going to be a battle within capital, even if it's that, on the terms of, you know, is it, sort of a neo-imperial, militaristic, sort of Halliburton capital that's going to dominate, or is it, you know, a deregulated finance capital? I mean, those
right.
type branches of capital have been battling it out
yes.
in the global economy. Now the question is, how much are we going to be players? You know,
exactly.
how much are social movements going to be players? And are we going to voice another alternative? Now, I think what you're absolutely right in saying that much has changed. Now, a lot of these type of things were foreseeable, not foreseeable in their specifics, but foreseeable in their general details. As I say, the crisis of market fundamentalism has been going on for 10 years.
Right.
And
now,
and
it's sort now of it's hitting home.
You know?
Right, precisely.
And, it, you know, as sort of a funny aside to that, funny and not so funny, is if you look at the Latin American reaction to the financial crisis in the United States. I don't know if you follow these, but you had Latin American leaders who at first were you know, I hate to say it, but they were almost sort of overjoyed. And this ran from Chavez, you know, further left to Lula in the center. You know,
how could there not be an element of Schadenfreude, of course?
Right. Yeah. Well, right. And there's that Edmund Wilson quote from 1929 where he says, you know, you couldn't help but feel exhilarated to see this, you know, gigantic fraud fall apart, you know. And I think that Latin America felt some of that, that having experienced that hardship, having experienced the crisis for so many years, to finally see that hit the United States, there was a sense of, well, now you have to, you know, sort of take your own medicine. But that was very quickly followed by a sense of, oh, crap. Because the United States is the world's largest economy, doesn't go down by itself. It
right.
goes down kicking, and it takes other people with it. And that's
exactly.
a real danger in Latin America. You know, there's some sense that this might be avoided. But to give a sense of this, you know, there has been look, we lived through at least 20, 25 years where that model of neoliberalism, that model of market fundamentalism, which I talked about before, privatization, deregulation, austerity, these programs were in the ascendancy through the Reagan years, through the Thatcher years, through the rise of the Washington Consensus from the 70s, you know, really through up until the turn of the millennium. That idea that we should hand over larger and larger parts of public life to the unregulated market was gaining power. Well, you've seen a reversal of that. You know, we've seen a reversal of that in the last 10 years, and I think that we're now seeing an accelerated reversal of that in the wake of the crises.
All right. And now, when you say we've seen a reversal in the last 10 years, you're talking about, I assume, you know, developments in Latin America and
Exactly. Mm-hmm. All over the world, but starting with the Asian financial crisis, the countries that were burned by the IMF, in particular, the World Bank to a lesser extent, but the IMF in that crisis, you know, really started seriously questioning, you know, the idea that they should follow those Washington Consensus prescriptions. And they started building up huge capital reserves in Asia so that they would never again have to go back to the IMF in a time of crisis. That's going to be tested now, right? It's going to be tested now that we're having a global crisis.
Right, but there wasn't the same kind of move away from basic free market precepts that we've seen in Latin America.
Right. No, not nearly as fully formed or you know, the radical nature of the Latin American experiment has been much more profound, you know. But you've seen a questioning of, you know, of sort of that hyper-capitalist mode, mm-hmm. you know, and a sort of a searching for, you know, whether it's a neo-Keynesian or a neo-developmentalist type of model, even in countries that are not particularly radical.
Or now you mean in Asia?
Even in Asia, yes.
Like where in Asia? Because, I mean, certainly Japan has not retreated an inch from neoliberal precepts.
Well, I think it's some of these countries that, you know, that were – I mean, you have a domestic political situation in each country. And, you know, and they're really the, you know, the people who – I know a lot more about Latin America than I do Asia, so really should have the Asian mm-hmm. experts talk about this. But, you know, so even just if you look at the principle of capital controls. Right. After, you know, that was something that was being eliminated after the Asian financial crisis. This is something that's come back. Mm. You know, Malaysia, which did have some capital controls, fared a lot better in the crisis, and the countries looked at that as a model. They've been talking about building an Asian, as opposed to an IMF, an Asian monetary fund, or an Asian, you know, stronger system of Asian development institutions to sort of come together there. And the currency reserves are now influencing that. These countries are building up massive surpluses, massive reserves. There's now what's called the Chiang Mai Initiative, an initiative to share these surpluses within the region, sort of similar in certain ways to the Bank of the South, which is what we've seen in Latin America, where the countries of Latin America, you know, Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, all these countries formed their own development bank, which was an explicit challenge to the World Bank, you know, and they said, well, we're going to do development lending on our own terms, you know, and even those countries that are more moderate within that constellation. The, you know, the Lula da Silva government in Brazil were explicitly almost anti-imperialist about this. They said, you know, the time has come for us to break from that, to not have to go begging Washington for money. Mm-hmm. There's been overtones of that even in Asia, even mm-hmm. which is admittedly a much less radical situation. Now, what makes the Latin American situation, you know, much more radical, and we can talk more about this, is that social movement government interplay. That it's not just that we've seen left-of-center governments be elected, but we've seen very strong social movements in the streets that are holding those governments accountable.
Absolutely. Okay, I should say, given that it's now 12:30 in the morning here on Listener Supported Non-Commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, and the tally still stands at a whopping zero, quite predictably, I should say that this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with me, Bill Weinberg, and we're speaking with Mark Engler, who is discussing his new book, How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy, which was released by Nation Books here in New York. This year, 2008, hot off the presses, critical background to the current financial crisis and how it's been brewing due to the politics of the neoliberalism and so-called Washington consensus for a long time. So there, somebody is calling. That's music to our ears. If you want a copy of this book, it can be yours, signed by the author. Signed by Mark Engler right here in the studios of WBAI for a pledge of $50. A pledge of $25 is the minimum to make you a member of the station. If that's what you can afford, we'll take that, please. Call 212-209-2950 and pledge $25. But if you can afford $50, you get your very own signed copy of How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy, by Mark Engler. And if you want to pledge somewhere in between, pledge $30, and that will get you a WBAI t-shirt, the lovely purple heart, golden-winged, purple-hearted t-shirt designed by Sidney Smith, which is sort of a play on the Sufi symbol, so it's very appropriate for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. For a pledge of $30 or for a pledge of $65, you get the BAI cap. But the special pledge that we're offering you tonight is the special premium we're offering for you tonight for a $50 pledge is How to Rule the World, your own personal signed copy of this quite timely, I would say vitally important book by Mark Engler, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy. So could we please get some calls? And I've got a lot more questions, which I would like to ask Mark. So I'd love to continue this interview and keep some interesting content coming at you, because I philosophically believe that despite the fact that we're having a marathon or a fun drive, maybe even especially because we're having a fun drive, I have responsibility to bring some, informative and engaging radio and not just repeat the telephone number over and over again with mantra-like monotony. But we do have to prevail upon people to call and jack the is it actually up to 100? We've got some interference on the closed-circuit television, so I think it might be up to 100. That's a start, but it's only a start. So please, can we get some people calling? 212-209-2950 is the number. Once again, a pledge of $50 will, in addition to making you a member of WBAI, and you actually get the right to vote in the listener board elections and all that stuff, will also get you your own very own signed copy of How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy by Mark Engler. So please do give us a call. 212-209-2950 is the number, and the phones are not ringing. So rather than continue to repeat the number with mantra-like monotony, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Rather than just doing that endlessly, why don't we play some more music? To give people a chance to call in while we play some music and make a pledge of $50. That's what we're asking you to pledge tonight. By the way, we only have 5 copies of Mark's book available. So want them to move. And if people will, if you want Mark's book, you should call now, because probably, well, the If the tallies are already up to 100, two of them are already gone, so there's only three left. So we've got a 2 minute and 50 second rocker lined up here to play. So while we're playing that, why don't at least two more people call in, and the tally will be up to $200, and then we can continue our interview. So why don't we do that? Okay, everybody? Once again, the number is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And here's another thematically appropriate song coming at you. Barrett Strong, also from 1960, taking the Wayback Machine to that year 1960 with a song called Money. Now, money don't get everything, that's true, but what it don't get, WBAI can't use. Not when it comes to paying the rent and, you know, making sure that we've got working equipment. You know, this is New York City, and it costs a lot of money to pay the rent, and it costs a lot of money to keep that transmitter going, and it costs a lot of money to, you know, keep the studio going. And as you know, I'm always griping about how we have malfunctioning equipment here and so on. This is a shoestring operation. It costs a lot of money to keep a radio station going in New York City. So you want WBAI to be around to fight the good fight at this particularly critical moment where we seem to be at a global turning point in terms of the global economic equation and juxtaposition of power and the whole notion of how to rule the world. So you're going to want BAI to be around. And one way to assure that WBAI is going to be around is to do your part by calling 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 is the number. Once again, a pledge of $50 will get you a copy of Mark Engler's book, How to Rule the World, The Battle Over the Global Economy, signed by the author right here in the studios of WBAI. Now, the tally still stands at 100, but when I went back, whoa, now it stands at 136. Okay, there. I was just going to say, when I went back in the tally room, Gerald was on the telephone taking a pledge, presumably. So I was hoping that we could, move the remaining three copies of Mark's book, and that the tally would be up to 200. But that's not the case. But I'll tell you why. We'll give you the benefit of the doubt, since somebody did call, and maybe Gerald's back on the telephone again. We'll give you the benefit of the doubt, and we'll keep going with a little bit more content for the time being, and assume that people are going to call over the course of the next, say, 10 minutes while we continue with our interview with Mark Engler. So please do call and make a pledge if you want a copy of his book. The number is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. So, Mark, you sort of pose these two different forms of or two different varieties of the basic power equation, sort of the Clinton model of using soft power and sort of emphasizing corporate globalization, and then there's the Bush model, which is more unilateralist and more based on hard power or military power, and more based on U.S. Hegemony as opposed to multilateralism. But really, I mean, this big thrust of corporate globalization that we've seen really began, I would say, with the election of Reagan. So how do you, before Clinton was elected, under the Reagan and Bush one administrations, how did you see these two tendencies sort of playing out?
Right. Well, that's a good question.
Whoops. I'm sorry. I didn't have your mic up. Start over again.
I think that is a good question, because I think you could take this back even further. You say, well, how is this playing out in the Carter period? And there's some interesting debates and discussions about that. I think that we've always seen a tension in capitalism that, that's gone between some of these different poles. I mean, I think you've always seen different fault lines in capitalism. And I think that that's one of the, this is one of the dilemmas that we face on the left, is I think that we're very good at seeing when our own movements are fractured and divided. I think that we can see a million different ways when we're not able to come together as a unified whole. On the other hand, I think that it's very difficult for us to see a lot of times that in our adversaries and political and corporate elites. I mean, I think that we look at that and we sort of imagine this sort of unified front. We sort of imagine a fist. But of course, there are some of those divisions that exist, and at different moments they create very powerful distinctions. Now, was that distinction particularly relevant in the Reagan years? I'm not – a good example is not coming to mind of when that how that tension was playing out in the 80s, in the same way that we've seen it play out in some very concrete ways in the last 10 years. So, for example, a story that I used at the beginning of the book is we saw a very interesting manifestation of this at the World Economic Forum in Davos in 2001, where the World Economic Forum, for people who may not be familiar with it, if there is a place where the global elites do get together and scheme about how to rule the world, this is at the World Economic Forum that takes place usually early every year. It usually takes place at this ultra elite resort in the Swiss Alps, and the idea is you're going to get political elites and also corporate elites, elites from the business world together. So you get the Tony Blairs of the world together with Bill Gates, together with the Saudi princes, and they all sort of have this confab. In 2001, it was a very interesting situation because you had Bush administration officials there. This is right before the invasion of Iraq, who were very determinedly trying to push that invasion, trying to make the case for war. And you had Colin Powell there trying to pitch the necessity of an invasion of Iraq.
This was in 2001.
2003, I'm
2003,
sorry.
2003.
I might have said 2001. Yeah. I meant to say 2003.
Right.
In January 2003, And
that was the one that was right here in New York, wasn't it?
No, I believe the 2002 was here in New York.
Oh, right, you're
and
correct.
This was
yes.
the first year that was back in
right,
Davos.
Right, in Davos, right, yes, yes,
and,
yes.
But while the Bush administration was pushing the war, the corporate elites there just weren't having it. And so you had a Newsday reporter there, Lori Garrett, who had a very vivid account of this, where she said Colin Powell got up, made the speech of his life trying to promote the Iraq war, and the sharpest attack came not just not from Amnesty International, not from some Islamic representative. It came from the head of the biggest bank in the Netherlands. And that was an image that really, you know, stayed with me, the banker, you know, going after the Secretary of State, because we so often see those type of people working in concert, you know, the state and corporate interests being unified. But this was a moment where there was, you know, some disjuncture there. And so that's sort of the distinction I want to highlight. And especially now, as I say, moving into in a period with Obama that is going to be a shift from the Bush years that does mark some important differences. But at the same time, have some tendencies that harken back to that Clinton model of corporate globalization that we need to be very concerned about.
Mm-hmm. And then there is the whole question of the Iraq war and whose interest it actually served. You've had a very interesting discussion of the various interpretations of what were the motives behind the Iraq war.
Well, I think that's true. You know, I take the neocons at their word to some extent. I mean, they had a vision for how this war would advance U.S. national interests, how it would reorient not just one country, not just create regime change in Iraq, but would reorient the entire Middle East to reshape the Middle East in the image of U.S. interests, so that, you know, we would have a friendly, democratic, pro-U.S. state in Iraq. This would allow us to break with Saudi Arabia. This would create regime change in Syria, in Iran, and create an entire restructuring that would benefit the United States. Now, of course, there is a clear economic element here. I mean, I do believe the Iraq war was a war for oil. But it wasn't a short-term war for oil in the way that we think of it sometimes, that they just wanted to go in and seize the oil fields and give out the spoils. This was a long-term war for oil. You know, this is a war where they were willing to create costs in the global economy, you know, to pay a price for U.S. dominance in a way that doesn't fit in with, you know, the corporate fixation on quarterly profits, you know, on immediate returns. And so if you go sector by sector, it's very interesting to see who supported the Iraq war and who didn't. Now, of course, corporate America doesn't get out on the street and join the anti-war protests. So corporate America by and large was either supportive or they were silent about it, or there's some grumbling. You know, there was some interesting grumbling, but most of that took place a year or so later. But you did have, an interesting sector by sector development. So even those sectors that we consider, I mean, there are certain sectors like the hotel hospitality industry. They were furious about about the whole war on terror. You know, they said this is damning for our industry. You know, even the screenings at the airports, all of the restricted immigration, everything that made it more difficult to travel, they were up in arms about this. And they, you know, again, said this was destroying brand America. This is destroying our ability to do business. But even if we look at, for example, the oil industry, well, the oil industry was sort of divided about the Iraq war. On the one hand, they sort of had dollar signs in their eyes. You know, they saw this as potentially being a tremendously lucrative thing, that they thought that they could, sign the service provision contracts that would effectively give them control over oil in Iraq. On the other hand, you know, the oil industry always saw Saddam Hussein as someone they could do business with. You know, they were doing all right. You know, they were making money, and they were worried that this whole thing could be a fiasco. You know, they were torn between greed and fear, as one oil analyst put it. That's a perspective we don't hear a lot about. You know, if you look at the arms industry, you know, there's an interesting divide in the arms industry because, you know, the big weapons manufacturers, you know, really what's the core of the military-industrial complex, they don't make their money off of, you know, the hot wars, the shooting wars. You know, they don't make their money by arming troops. They make their money off of major research and development into new weapon systems. They make their money off of that huge Pentagon budget, you know, $500 billion, whatever it's up to now, that's been perpetuated under Democratic administrations, under Republican administrations, year in, year out, et cetera. So on the one hand, they're very excited about the war on terror, you know, as this broad, never-ending war that will go on forever, that will demand ever higher military budgets. But when you talk about a specific shooting war like Iraq, this creates a lot of insecurity for the big arms manufacturers. They think, well, if you know, if this attention goes over to arming the troops, you know, then maybe there's a demand to cut back. You know, maybe there's a zero-sum thing on some of that new weapon system development. You know, this stuff can shake out bad. And in fact, as a percentage of their profits, you had a lot of smaller startup companies that were sort of getting in to get in on the action with Iraq. You know, that's why you saw some of this cronyism and some of this, you know, sort of these new slapshot, not very professional operations sort of being created to cash in on the Iraq, because the military-industrial complex as an institution, it was much less interested in that hot war and that invasion than they were in the sort of prolonged, massive, you know, military buildup that we've had, you know, going back, you know, well, really since World War II, but particularly since Reagan.
Mm. Well, I would imagine they'd be pretty happy at the air war element, because they like to see all those cruise missiles being destroyed, so the Pentagon is going to need to buy new ones.
Right, but even then...
But once it turns into this grueling counterinsurgency thing, that's...
Right, the counterinsurgency, yeah. Definitely, and that's bad. It's all a PR thing, you know, if it's... you know, if it's good PR, you know, the first Gulf War, you had, you know, the Patriot missiles going up. Now, of course, this stuff wasn't the actual track record of these right. weapon systems wasn't nearly as good as what the advertised version was. But the PR version of it was that look at all these great high-tech new weapons yes. that the United States now has at its disposal. Well, that did tremendous things for them because this, you know, sort of says, oh, you know, we're always building cutting-edge weapons. We need to build more of these. That's something that the military-industrial complex is absolutely thrilled about. But when it comes to simply rearming the ships, arming the troops, equipping the troops, that's not something that that the arms industry was particularly interested
unless in. You include Halliburton and Blackwater and so on, who made a mint, quite
right.
obviously.
Right, sure. I mean, yeah. it depends. Right. I mean, it depends on who we group in. And people were making money off of this war. I'm not denying that right. by any means. I'm just saying that. You know, some of these things go, you know, split. They break out a little bit differently than we sometimes think that they
yes.
will.
Well, the whole question of oil and whether this was a war for oil, quote unquote, is one which is frequently misunderstood and causes me a great deal of consternation. Because on one hand, people tend to think of it in these oversimplified terms that if it's a war for oil, then it's just a windfall for Exxon. And obviously it hasn't been, because the situation in Iraq has been too chaotic for many of the majors to really get in there and directly control the oil in a serious way. Although that was their design, of course. And on the other hand, you know, people will say, well, you know, if it hasn't been this windfall for Exxon, then it wasn't really a war for oil. And it was just purely this neocon ideological thing, which is frequently posed with strong overtones of anti-Semitism, I will add. But you sort of make the point that, well, it can be a war for oil and not be about corporate profits per se, but oil as a means of maintaining U.S. global dominance.
That's right. And I think it's, you know, it's a 10, 15, 20, 30-year war for oil. It's a war for control of strategic resources, you know, more than a war for direct control over the oil fields in a short-term type of Exxon contract. Type of way. I absolutely agree with that.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of the, you know, the neocons' own policy documents have been pretty explicit on this as well.
Oh, sure. Well, that's the thing. You know, on the one hand, you know, the United States will fervently deny that it, you know, that it has anything other than the most noble motives and intentions in pulling off an operation like this. But on the other hand, you have to be stupid not to recognize that, you know, as one of the most prominent war advocates said, that this country is floating on a sea of oil. I mean, it's the obvious elephant in the room.
Now, who said that? Do you remember?
I can't remember if it was Wolfowitz or I believe it was Wolfowitz, actually. Yeah. But But, you know, there are very explicit policy declarations going back certainly to Carter that says, you know, the United States has a vital national interest in the Middle East, in Middle Eastern affairs, because, you know, there's massive oil resources. That's not a conspiracy. That is stated U.S. policy. So to that extent, the war for oil is absolutely uncontroversial. On the other hand, as a, you know, as a PR measure, that's not something that the United States likes to.
Right. It's got to be Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Right. It's not something they like to admit. And so I think partly because of that, because the obvious discussion of national interest tends to be obscured, then the oil debate takes on these sort of conspiratorial overtones that, you know, that it doesn't really need to have. You know, there's, you know, you can talk about oil as very clearly in the United States' interest, in any country's interest, to control those type of resources.
Well, that raises the question of what we mean by the United States' interest, because it's not in the interest of not in the interest of the citizens, the people down at the bottom of the social pyramid. In fact, the war drove up the price of oil.
Right.
Right. And made things more difficult for us down here at the bottom of the social pyramid.
Right. Well, I mean,
but in terms of maintaining the U.S. as the preeminent global power, I mean, there was actually this policy document, this Pentagon policy document that you cite, that was written in 1992 by Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby way back in 92, which pretty explicitly stated that the U.S. needs to maintain the oil resources of the Persian Gulf under its control in order to prevent the rise of any aspiring world powers from challenging the United States.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, the question of national interest is really a fundamental question. I mean, I think if we get back to that core interest of how to rule the world, of what kind of international society we want to have, the question of national interest is a very important one because, as you say, the interests of the military-industrial complex is not necessarily the interests of the American people. The interests of Wall Street are not necessarily the interests of the American people. So, for example, we have a very live debate about this going on with Latin America, and I think that this is actually something that we should be engaging with the public. And this, everyone should be talking with their friends, their family, with their coworkers about this. When you see media coverage of Latin America, well, what is the U.S. national interest in Latin America? Now, if you go back over the last 40 years, what we've always said it is promoting democracy and reducing poverty. Well, if that's the case, we should be celebrating, you know, this leftward shift in Latin America. It's democratic. You know, these are democratically elected governments. You have direct democracy being expressed, you know, by popular protest, by democratic protest. Democracy does not mean that whoever is George Bush's buddy gets elected. You know, democracy means that the people's will and the popular demand is respected. These are democratically elected governments. So if we're interested in promoting democracy, the shift that we've seen since 2000 in Latin America is absolutely in our national interest. Reducing poverty. You know, this program of neoliberalism has failed to produce economic growth. This is now this is the standard, this is the benchmark that even the most mainstream economists want to use. From a progressive perspective, there are all sorts of problems with measuring your national well-being with GDP economic growth. For example, it doesn't measure inequality. You know, if Bill Gates makes trillions and the rest of us don't get anything,
right,
that's economic growth. You know, Robert Kennedy gave a beautiful speech about this where he says, well, you know, if you get in a car accident and you have to have an ambulance rush you to a hospital, well, that's economic growth. You know, the hospital and the ambulance. If you build a prison, that's economic growth. If you build more guns, that's economic growth. But it doesn't measure the quality of society that you want to have. At the same time, even if we accept that standard, that most mainstream standard of economic growth, neoliberalism has just flat out failed. So you had, per capita growth from 1960 to 1980 of about 70% per person in Latin America, which is a pretty substantial increase in development as is traditionally defined. In the neoliberal period between 1980 and 2000, it was just 7%. Per person, hardly anything at all, you know. And this is where there have been talk in mainstream.
Oh no, that's where.
What's that? That's in Latin America.
Just in Latin America.
Yeah, that's in Latin America. And so there's talk here, but there was, you know, the UN, United Nations The UNDP Human Development Program came out with a report in 2003. It calls the 1990s another lost decade in development. And it says those countries throughout the world, not just in Latin America, that most closely followed neoliberal policies, that most closely followed the Washington consensus, were those that did the worst. Well, this is a tremendous statement, calling the 1990s a lost decade. I mean, this is supposed to be one of the most dynamic decades in the history of global capitalism, you know, one of the most booming decades that we've ever seen. And here is the UNDP. This isn't, you know, exactly a left institution. It's a mainstream development institution saying that the poorest countries in the world simply did not benefit during that decade. In fact, Mark Malik Brown called for the director of the UNDP. He called for a, quote, guerrilla assault on the Washington consensus. And I love this quote. I bring this quote up all the time because
that was when? When did he
make that? Was 2003. Mm-hmm. You know, there are those of us, you know, on the left who call for guerrilla assaults all the time, and, you know, no one really takes it too seriously. But when you have Mark Malik Brown, when you have the head of a major UN agency calling for a guerrilla assault on the Washington consensus, you know that the debate has changed. And so that's why I say we're in a critical moment right now where those failed models have created backlash. They've created a moment where we can have a debate about what is the United States' national interest. It's not Wall Street's interest. You know, I think the American people are really waking up to that in a serious way in the wake of the financial crisis, saying that the interest of the American people is not the same as the interest of finance capital on Wall Street. It's not the United States' national interest is not to be the world's policeman. It's not to preemptively invade other countries. I think that's been very clearly established. And I think that that's opened a much wider debate and a very exciting debate about alternatives that we haven't had in the last 20 years.
Well, if you out there feel this has been an interesting interview, and we still have a half an hour to go, you're going to want to read Mark's book. And you can get a copy of Mark's book signed here in the studios of WBAI by the author Mark Engler himself by making a pledge. Get your very own copy of How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy, information-packed book with lots of facts and analysis that you need in order to understand why this transition which the planet appears to be facing. Now, I hear the telephones are ringing back there in the tally room, but the tally also appears to be standing at just $136, which means that we haven't even moved all of – we've only moved a minimum or rather a maximum of two of the copies that we have, the five copies we have of How to Rule the World. So we really want to move at least all of those copies of How to Rule the World. So we need three people to call in and pledge $50 and become a member of WBAI and get your very own signed copy of How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy by Mark Engler. So we are calling right now for a guerrilla assault on the tally lines. 212-209-2950. Now, the way it always seems to work is that the tally, you know, rushes ahead in the last half hour just to, you know, because you people have got to make me sweat for the first hour of the show. Well, okay, you've made me sweat. You win. Now we only have a half an hour left, and we need that tally to just surge forward, and we really need to break at least, you know, we want all those copies to move. We're ready up to, somebody pledge 36, I guess, to get a copy of, rather to get the T-shirt plus $6. So that means we move two copies of the book. So we have three more. That's 150. So that's 250 plus 36. What's 250 plus 36?
286.
So at a minimum, we want to go home with $286 tonight, which is actually pretty pathetic. So let's get it going, folks. You know that if you're a listener to WBAI and you're actually listening to my voice right now and you appreciate the programming that we do around here and you're not a member, well, you know how to rectify that. So please call 212-209-2950. It's really important. Pledge $50. Get your own copy of Mark's book. And if you can't pledge $50, then pledge $30 and get the T-shirt. And if you can't even pledge $30, then pledge $25 and just become a member of WBAI. That's all we ask. So please, Let's take another little musical break, give people a chance to call in, and then I've got more questions for Mark, which I would like to ask him. So rather than having to repeat the telephone number over with mantra-like monotony, I'd like to get back to the interview and actually give you some interesting content in the remaining, now less than a half an hour. So please, while we take this musical break, please do your part. Call 212-209-2950. We're asking just three people out there to pledge. I won't stop again and harangue you if the tally moves up to that 280 in the next 3 minutes. So we're just asking for three more people to pledge $50 to get your own very own signed copy of How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy by Mark Engler, hot off the presses from Nation Books. So please, three people pledge, three people pledge $50 and we can just give you content for the remaining now 25 minutes. And if you can't pledge the 50, pledge whatever you can, just give us a spoonful. All we want is a spoonful. Yeah, just give WBAI a spoonful. That's all we ask. So all we can afford, just give us a spoonful. Whatever you can afford. 212-209-2950. And I went back there and Gerald, who was heroically battling the controls all by himself because nobody else would come in to volunteer on this miserable night, despite the fact that I'm here in the studio and Mark Engler is here in the studio. So just give us a spoonful. Just call 212-209-2950. So I'm assuming that we've got some tally lag here. And if nobody picks up, then just please keep calling. Just keep calling back, and Gerald will pick up eventually. He's the only guy back there, and the phones were ringing when I went back there. So I think probably we're doing okay. I hope we're doing okay, although the tally still hasn't moved from that 136. I assume we've got some tally lag here. Please do keep calling, and if nobody picks up, just call back, 212-209-2950. Once again, a pledge of $50. You'll get your own very signed copy of the book, How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy. And, of course, that was the one and only Howlin' Wolf with his classic song Spoonful, also recorded back in 1960. Somehow all the songs I brought tonight are from the year 1960. I didn't plan it that way, but that's the way it's working out. All right, so should we keep on going with the interview here on the assumption that we've got tallylag and we really are going to at least break 300? That's all I want tonight, is just break 300. Can we do that, please, folks? 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. So, well, you know, this whole question of economic growth. Now, you say that there wasn't actually economic growth in Latin America over the course of the 90s, or that it just failed to help the people at the, you know, the masses at the bottom of the social pyramid.
Well, both, actually. I mean, yeah. it there was tremendous inequality, so the growth that did exist went to the top. But overall, the growth was horrible. It was very, very, very low throughout the region. Now, it varies by country to country, but the numbers are just abysmal. And compared to, like I say, the previous 20-year period, these are comparable periods. You had ups and downs in the business cycle in each case, but the averages, the way that it netted out, was that the neoliberalism just hasn't produced. And that really is at the core of this leftward shift in Latin America. You know, this is at the heart of the issue. The White House would like us to believe that this is just, the machinations of Hugo Chavez, that there's this fiery dictator who's somehow warping minds and convincing everyone to turn against the United States. But these Latin American governments, can see the numbers. You know, they see that this just
hasn't... I'm not sure I quite get the no growth during that period thing, though. Because, I mean, certainly throughout most of the 90s, the price of oil was pretty depressed, which is going to affect Venezuela and Mexico in a big way. But there was loads of resource extraction going on at a quite accelerated rate all over Latin America during that period. I mean, minerals and timber and...
The numbers are bad, The numbers are bad when you come down to it. And I don't have the charts in front of me, but we could go over them. And then there's a difference between, per capita growth, whether you have enough economic expansion to keep up with the fact that, the populations of these countries are growing very rapidly. Mm-hmm. So if you have more and more people entering the workforce with, that's not creating enough jobs to make up for it, it's not going to cut it. But, it creates a very interesting situation where it's sort of like, do those of us on the left sort of want to out-capitalist the capitalists? Are we proposing, with a return to, to some sort of neo-Keynesian model, with a return to some sort of neo-developmentalist model, are we ultimately just proposing a better capitalism than their capitalism, which was so unequal, so extractive that it didn't build a middle class, it didn't build a base of consumers, undermine demand globally. Ultimately, that's not the way to build a stable capitalism. That's sort of the irony of some of this stuff, by focusing on the quarterly profits, sometimes you do things that are not in your own long-term self-interest. So, the liberal sort of Keynesian capitalist would say, well, this is how we, this is how we have to save capitalism, is ultimately by regulating it. And certainly we see that now with the financial crisis.
Right.
This was a crisis of deregulation where even John McCain, he says, we've created Wall Street greed that has allowed these firms to treat the American economy like a casino. Well, this is an extraordinary quote. I mean, this is from, one of the biggest free marketeers around. But even he sort of turns on, on this sort of totally, no holds barred type of capitalism. Now, of course, he wants to chalk this up to a few bad apples and not make any, systemic conclusions, about how this greed is in fact the very driver of the system. Nevertheless, it's an important point that there's even a lot of people within the business world who realize that some of this stuff is not sustainable. That this is not the way to go about building a decent economy that even serves their own interests of making money.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but in terms of the question of what we are actually advocating, I've got To me, you know, we're not allowed to say this out loud. We haven't been allowed to say this out loud for the past generation since Reagan. But to me, you know, the notion of economic growth has just got, you know, some real obvious contradictions. We live on a planet of limited resources. All right. Endless economic growth is sooner or later going to run dry. It's going to destroy the planet and it's going to come to a grinding halt. You know, it's just a matter of time.
Right.
And this whole, you know, notion that, well, we support a, you know, capitalism with a better deal for those of us at the bottom of the social pyramid. You know, even this has sort of been the ultra left or anarchist critique of Hugo Chavez, is that, you know, he's just trying to build state capitalism. And there's this so-called Bolivarian bourgeoisie, which is emerging in Venezuela. And, you know, you've still got the same bosses now just in the public sector rather than the private sector. But this raises the question of, you know, what is the next step, you know, beyond that? If we're actually going to actually be so ambitious as to look beyond capitalism, if we can actually, you know, put that back on the spectrum of debate for the first time since the Berlin Wall came down, what is, you know, that vision of what a world beyond capitalism could look like and how we get from here to there?
Right.
That's a tough question, I know.
There's no easy answer to that.
Exactly.
I do think you point out the absolutely critical, conflict and contradiction that we're facing. This is something that I wrote recently. You know, we want to demand a new deal from Obama, and we do want public consumption to and demand to revive, so that we don't have a much deeper economic downturn that's going to throw people out of work, that's going to have real consequences for working people. On the other hand, while we could use Keynesianism to try to revive that appetite, we have to deal with the fact that it's that very same hunger for always consuming more that's ultimately destroying the planet, you know. And I think that we do need to get at that, that idea that, perpetual acquisition, perpetual consumption is at some point going to reach a limit. Now, I think that there's actually a very broad consensus around this, to the extent that there's an awareness of global warming that's emerged in the last few years, that there's something like the demand for green jobs, a new green economy has became a very, very mainstream type of demand, you know, something that we saw a lot of, in the presidential campaign, for example. However, you have these people, even Al Gore among them, who think that, well, we can sort of that there doesn't need to be a fundamental change to the system, that we can sort of come up with new technologies that will allow us to sort of innovate our way out of,
Right, and Obama's program is starting to look very much like that.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that there are some serious questions about that. So, what do we want and how do we get it? Well, first things first, we do need some growth, you know, to the extent that if you have a terribly unequal world situation, the only way that you're going to get, some immediate relief for people who are living in abject poverty in many places of the world. I mean, remember, we have 2 billion people in the world who are living still on less than a dollar a day. I mean, this is extreme poverty roughly half the world is living on very, very basic incomes. There's only two ways to get that. Either you can make the economy bigger, which is more growth, and then take the gains from that growth and distribute it in a more equal way, or you can take away the property, assets, wealth that's already been created and redistribute it. Well, that latter option is very, very difficult to implement, and oftentimes is a very bloody type of thing. I mean, there are some ways to do it. For example, the wealth taxes, what the Republicans called the death tax, what a lot of people on left circles have called the Paris Hilton tax, that we should tax legacies so that we're not creating.
And you also mentioned the Tobin tax in your book,
right? Sure. So there's some.
What is that in brief synopsis?
Right. So the Tobin tax just creates a very, very small tax on international financial transfers. So we have this money racing around the world at the press of a computer button. This would be an extremely small tax, 0.01% of the transaction. But because there's so much money that flies around, this would raise an enormous amount of money, and it would serve a cooling function to discourage just totally hot money, speculative type of financial transactions. That's something that even mainstream economists think is extremely sensible. The key thing about the Tobin tax, and the list here goes on and on, and this is what I write about in the book. You know, if you go to someplace like Porto Alegre, there's dozens and dozens of ideas, not just, you know, I mean, there's just...
What's the significance of Porto Alegre here?
Right. Well, Porto Alegre is, you know, is a physical manifestation of a lot of the different ideas that are being discussed. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of books, position papers.
Apart from a city in Brazil, what is Porto Alegre?
Oh, so Porto Alegre is the world social, is the home of the World Social Forum. So the people who are not familiar with the social forums, these are a space that people have been coming together in huge numbers, you know, and this is all a post 9/11 phenomenon too, where we've seen larger crowds at the social forums than ever existed at the protests against, you know, the World Bank, IMF, World Trade Organizations. We're getting upwards of 150,000 people coming to places like Porto Alegre, Brazil, or to Nairobi or Mumbai, when it's been held in different global cities, and this is conceived of as a space where representatives of social movements throughout the world can come together, they can talk about the work that they're actually doing, they can draw connections between their struggles and talk about their visions and their proposals for alternatives. And there's an agenda.
This is sort of set up as an alternative to the World Economic
Forum, which we discussed earlier.
Associated with Davos, Switzerland.
That's exactly right. And what's critical about this is the agenda that comes out of that. It's not just something that, you know, someone thought up in the shower, as I like to say. You know, it's not something that someone randomly came up with their own wish list. This is a set of demands that's related to actual struggles going on in the world that is directly connected to those social movements. And in many cases, they're we're winning on these demands. If we look at something like debt relief, if we look at what the what the landless workers movement in Brazil is doing with redistributing land and that demand for land reform. But the point here is that there are dozens and dozens of different demands, going from Tobin taxes and carbon taxes to living wage and anti-sweatshop laws, to antitrust laws, to demands for having water and other natural resources remain public good, defending the public commons. There's long, long lists of demands that translate into public policy proposals. The reason why things like the Tobin tax, tremendously sensible demand, the reason why these things are not implemented as public policy, it's not that the ideas are not there. It's that these are ideas that fly directly in the face of the interests of the most wealthy and consequently the most powerful people in our society.
Exactly.
The Wall Street elite absolutely hates the idea of a Tobin tax.
Of course.
You know, and they'll spend millions to fight against it. But it's a very good idea. And what that illustrates is that this is not just a battle of ideas. You know, it's a question of power. It's a question of are we able to organize people, you know, the power of organized people to combat the power of organized money. And that's been the struggle for a very long time, and it will continue to be the struggle. Now, I think in the immediate term, in terms of what do we want, how do we get it, that set of demands, that agenda is a very critical agenda. Not in that every demand is particularly radical, you know, but I think that just by taking the demands of neoliberalism, you know, the idea of market fundamentalism that's arisen in the past years and reversing down the line the mandates of neoliberalism, this will create a very, very different economy than what we know now. So, for example, they want to privatize everything public. Well, we want to keep things public. We want things that are in the public good. They want total deregulation. You know, they want lobbyists to write the rules for their own industries. Well, we're against that. You know, we want regulation. We want regulation that protects the environment. We want regulation that protects the common good. We want regulation that stops the sort of reckless speculation, financial speculation that created the crisis we're in now. They want, they want open markets, which, we want countries to have flexibility in deciding when they want to protect small farmers, when they want to promote local businesses. They want austerity, which means rolling back social services, cutting social services. Well, we want social services. You know, we want people to have health care as a human right. They want what they call flexible labor laws. Well, we want living wages. You know, we want unions to be protected. They want to lock all those policies in with new free trade deals, We're against that. We say no new trade deals. All of those things are – none of those things by themselves are particularly radical at all. On the other hand, that agenda, just again, reversing the neoliberal tenets, would create an economy very, very different than what we know now and certainly than what we've seen in the last 30 years. So, you know, this idea that there is no alternative, you know, it serves to naturalize a very radical agenda. You know, that agenda of deregulation, that deregulation doesn't happen by itself. It's not a naturally occurring phenomenon. That's why they hire an army of lobbyists to go to Washington to push that. Privatization doesn't happen by itself. You know, so just by reversing those things, it creates an alternative. You know, the alternative to CAFTA is no CAFTA. The alternative to invading Iraq is not invading Iraq. You know, we don't have to, you know, have a fully fleshed out, you know, economic program in order to create change at a very significant level. Now, on the other hand, I think that there are some exciting experiments that do take this further, and that really do suggest, you know, suggest different alternatives. I mean, these are some of the things like, you know, the Bolivian situation, where you have indigenous rights movements that are, you know, that are trying to, you know, have a vision of the economy that's based on, you know, community councils that have an active role in democratic decision making. That's a non-capitalist model. It's a pre-capitalist model of how to make economic decisions. You have the prefigurative type of movements, like what we saw with the occupied factories in
prefigurative.
Prefigurative is I mean that to say this is not a term that I made up, but people use this to say, well, this is these are the type of politics that take place in sort of small isolated incidents, and while they may not be you know, super significant or very big at the moment, they prefigure or they predict or they suggest something that could be much bigger. So, mm-hmm. for example, you have the occupied factories in Argentina. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm somewhat critical of these, actually, in that I think that sometimes on the left we get stars in our eyes about what a great thing these occupied factories are. And, in fact, if you go down to Argentina, it varies, you know, how things are actually going factory to factory varies a lot and who actually are the people and what their ideology is and what have you is not always what we expect it to be. Nevertheless.
All right. In what sense has it disappointed you?
You know, the idea of the principle of occupied factories, just to do a little background, is that if you have, you know, you have these situations where, you know, capital left, you know, they shut down the hotel, they shut down a factory, and the workers just stayed. You know, they went into work anyway, and they, to the best of their ability, restarted production, restarted these companies without, you know, the bosses being present, you know, and sort of ran the Baun Hotel in Buenos Aires, a very famous example. They ran as a worker-run collective, you know, as a hotel. Now, there are certain people in these movements that are very ideological about this and that have a vision of a different type of economy. There's other people who just need a job and want to go in and work. There's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, in terms of how people respond to, you know, a huge number of challenges, whether it's the boss coming back and demanding his, you know, his property back, whether it's, you know, interpersonal rivalries within, you know, the factories, whether it's deficits and the fact that it's difficult to run a profitable business, you know, whether it's...
Well, it still has to function in a capitalist macroeconomy.
Right, exactly. Yeah. All of those questions are very difficult to work out, and you have a huge range of opinion within the factories about these things. So these are not, you know, this is not a worker's paradise is what I'm trying to say, and anyone who investigates this closely will see this. On the other hand, the second point is that these are not a large portion of the Argentinian economy. I mean, this is, you know, we're talking maybe 100 workplaces, you know, numbers like up to 180 got thrown around sometimes. But these are, you know, this is as a percentage of the economy, as a percentage of the jobs in that economy.
Hence prefigurative.
Right. It wasn't a huge percentage. And therefore, we still need to be concerned about the Kirchners, about what the government is doing in that country. You know, we can't just throw out the state and say that this doesn't matter because we have these factories. On the other hand, you know, there's something very suggestive about that. That's why when we had a sit-down strike in Chicago, you know, this was hugely suggestive. The workers go in and refuse to leave that factory until they got, you know, what they were legally entitled to. In this case, it was not resuming production. It was just getting their severance pay and, you know, the 2 months notice that they were legally...
And they won.
And they won. Yeah. But, not only did they win, the public support and public sentiment in favor of those Chicago workers was just overwhelming.
Yep.
I mean, it was, you know, it wowed me. I was tremendously impressed. And, of course, I was, you know, I was humbled and wowed by the workers themselves. I mean, I was very supportive of this. But everyone was. And this went up through the chains of government, you know, through the local governments in Illinois, up to Obama himself, who, you know, who said that the workers were right, that they deserved to win. I don't know about you, Bill, but I cannot see Bill Clinton doing that. I cannot see an Al Gore. I cannot see an Al Gore, or at least the Al Gore we knew back in, you know, 1999, getting up and, you know, and standing up for those workers in the same way. So that's the prefigurative element of it.
Yes.
By itself, it doesn't take us to a new place, but it suggests something different. It suggests a different attitude about the economy that we can build from.
Suggest some potentialities which are at play, one hopes. So, well, if you want to find out more about all this, read How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Global Economy by Mark Engler. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Mark. It's been really fascinating.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be on the show.
And I think that we probably moved all of the copies of your book because the total now stands at 422. At least the phone was still ringing when Gerald, after Gerald came in and brought us the names to read out. So a big shout out to those of you who pledged tonight, to Eric Linton of Jersey City, to Pete Leather of Neptune City, New Jersey, to Columbia Fierro, right on, our good friend Columbia from New York, New York, from Manhattan, and another good friend of ours, Lucy McAllister, who never fails to come through. Thank you so much, Lucy. And Rafael Bruno in, well, I know Rafael Bueno, but maybe this is Rafael Bruno in Brooklyn, New York, and Francisco Cambero, also in Brooklyn, and Onkar Singh in Richmond Hill.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.